These everyday people are about to relive their dreams under hypnosis. They are not actors. Listen.
All of a sudden, we walk into a room. I turn around, there's no doors. There's no windows, and I have to go home.
As I go to kiss her, it seems as though we're surrounded by mosquitoes.
Only he's not wearing any clothes.
Charlie! Charlie, watch your bayonet! Watch your bayonet!
What are dreams? What do they mean? When you dream, you wander into another world where everything is strange and terrifying. When you dream, you become a nightwalker. And now, a warning from William Castle, producer of The Nightwalker.
Do you know that a dream can kill you? Gruesome thought, isn't it?
Do you hear that? It's the scream of a woman having a nightmare.
I love you so much.
That is the voice of a woman asleep, dreaming. Does her lover exist? Is he real or is he only a dream lover? This can happen to you, too.
I know why my dreams seem real. Because when I'm awake, my life with you is like a nightmare. My lover is only a dream, but he's still more of a man than you.
Your husband.
If you do, do not see the Nightwalker. It might be too much for you.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be necessary. Possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And I am pleased to introduce the man who has reintroduced the term Yerkes Mazurkes to the American public through his comics from the Gone World, of which I'm a fan. We'll talk more about those later on.
What a legacy, huh?
It is a legacy. We take him where we can find him, Michael H. Price. Mike, it's good to be visiting with you again.
Always a pleasure. What do we got cooking tonight? Yeah.
Well, what we got cooking is a movie that scared me to death back in 1965 when I saw it at the Claremore Theater, and it was a William Castle film, and I knew. As a kid, what would I have been, 16 then?
Sure.
You knew what William Castle had up his sleeve, or at least you knew what the name brand meant.
Yes, you did.
You actually had some close encounters with William Castle, as I remember.
Yeah, he was a pal of my theater operator uncle.
That was Grady.
Grady Wilson ran Interstate Theaters in West Texas, and Castle as fairly accurately depicted in Joe Dante's film Matinee,
yes.
Would go on the road like a carny huckster to promote his own movies. He was a little bit too big for that kind of nonsense, but he indulged in it delightedly. And, of course, it was the gimmicks that sold the Castle films. A lot of the Castle pictures really do hold up without the gimmicks, but it was the gimmicks in the theaters that made people curious enough to come see how thoroughly well he could scare them.
Right.
And,
now, did you meet him? I think you met him, if I recall, one of our past conversations when he was installing things in the seats for the Tingler?
Oh, yes. The Tingler was to be taken literally. The title was to be taken literally. That is, at strategic points during the film, as when the Tingler, the horrid creature from the spinal column, gets loose in the theater, the projectionist in the real world was to press a button in the projection booth and activate vibrators in certain seats. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the right place at the right time to help install those Tinglers.
They were actually little. I remember Rob White telling me, the script writer for House on Haunted Hill,
yeah,
or for the Tingler and the Tingler, mm-hmm, that they were little. That they bought them from an aircraft company. They were some sort of little aircraft motors, and they'd gotten them wholesale. Mm-hmm. And Rob White told me a story, and I hope we haven't talked about it on this podcast before. But he told me a story about a theater in an L.A. suburb that was showing The Nun Story with Audrey Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And they had installed, they'd come in and installed the little buzzers in the seats for the Tingler, but the Tingler wasn't supposed to come along for a couple of days. Well, this was the last night of The Nun Story. And according to Rob White, they had an audience of older people watching The Nun Story. I think this was in Westwood, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the projectionist, who hadn't been in on the putting the buzzers in the seats, looks over at this big buzzer on the side of the window and says, "Wonder what this does." And right in the saddest part of The Nun Story, he had 60-year-old women jumping up about 6 feet. Now, I'd like to think that's a real story. Rob White was a great storyteller, and it may be apocryphal. But I will tell you for sure that Rob White also told me, when I interviewed him for Fangoria years ago, that he parted ways with William Castle after Homicidal, because mm-hmm, he had not seen Psycho. And when William Castle brought him in for a story conference, he gave him all of these Psycho plot elements. And Rob White wrote it, and then he went out and saw Psycho, and he said the whole film was a ripoff of Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
So he got upset, and he left, and of course, you know, William Castle then eventually hooked up with Robert Bloch for two films, one of the ones that we're talking about tonight. Straightjacket was the first one with Joan Crawford.
Sure.
And then The Nightwalker, which didn't, as I recall, Michael, it didn't have a gimmick, did it?
No, the gimmick was the sudden surge into maturity, mm-hmm, for Bill Castle.
Good point. Which found its way even farther than in Rosemary's Baby, of course.
Correct, correct. Mm-hmm. A large number of the critics who were devoted to belittling William Castle looked upon The Nightwalker as just another in the so-called old gal cycle of horror films,
yeah, mm-hmm,
which we've discussed in print, and of course Castle had certainly exploited Joan Crawford during that cycle,
right? With Straightjacket, of course.
But yes, exactly. But to put Barbara Stanwyck, who probably did fit that description in a general way, and at least in generational terms, to put her in a glamorous, appealing, middle-aged leading lady role where she wasn't the villain, as would be the case in, say, Baby Jane or, any number.
Charlotte. Yeah.
Right, Charlotte. He let Barbara Stanwyck carry the picture as the endangered leading lady, still glamorous at this point.
She was age 57 at that time.
I believe that's right, yes. Mm-hmm. And very much the assertive female lead who also happens to be, like, really endangered and beset upon with these horrible visions.
You know, it was allegedly her last feature film. of course, she went from there to the Big Valley and played a similar, actually kind of a similar character. She was certainly glamorous in the Big Valley.
A very striking, sustained performance in the Big Valley. And, you know, Barbara Stanwyck had been around since, Depression years, if not earlier.
Actually, yeah, you know, she made some of those I remember specifically a film called Babyface that she made in the pre-Breen Office Hollywood.
Correct.
Where she sort of slept her way to the top. It was a wonderful picture.
And she had played the endangered romantic lead in The Bitter Tea of General Yin,
yes,
opposite Nils
right.
Astor.
Right.
For, of all people, Frank Capra, who ordinarily is not associated with that kind of heavy erotic drama.
Right, right. And, of course, the other thing that was put in here was they paired her with, or Castle, I should say, paired her with Robert Taylor, her husband, from 1939 to 51. And he had just finished his own TV series, The Detectives, which was a very well-received show in its time. TV show, and he'd been the head of a group of police detectives, and so maybe that was the gimmick also to pair up Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor for one more go around. But I tell you another thing that's in this picture. I'd like to talk a little bit about the supporting characters. One was a fascinating B picture actress. Making a kind of a secondary comeback, not like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and even Olivia de Havilland and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. And we alluded to these, what did you call them, Hag? What was the term?
Oh, the old gal thrillers.
Old gal thrillers. Which
a lot of people call them hag horror, which is really a dismissive, contemptuous
term. It is,
term.
Because Barbara Stanwyck is hardly a hag, and neither is Joan Crawford and Straightjacker, for that matter. But it really started with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and it got Betty Davis an Oscar nomination, Victor Bruno an Oscar nomination, and that was a really kind of a trend there for a few years.
I think Joan Crawford had presaged Baby Jane with a picture called Female on the Beach.
Right.
In the 50s, where she does a role very similar to what Barbara Stanwyck does in The Nightwalker, that is, the endangered romantic figure who is obviously, to the eye of the camera and to the eye of the viewer, a bit past the prime of youth.
And I'd never thought about comparing those two films before just now, and that's right, yeah.
Definitely a link. The Nightwalker is more a film noir than a horror thriller, although the elements are shared in common by many films.
Yeah, there's some great horror elements in that. And the one I want to talk about, and she really doesn't have much to do, but she was in Straight Jacket, just like with Castle, she was in Straight Jacket. She was also in Nightwalker. And that's Rochelle Hudson.
Rochelle Hudson, what a beauty. Oklahoma.
She was Oklahoma, but there's a weird, as I researched her for a story recently, or actually it may have been for a book, but whatever it was, I was researching her, and I had always thought that she came from Claremore, which is right down the road from my hometown of Chelsea. But as I got to researching her life, it appears that she was actually born in Oklahoma City.
So I've turned up, yeah.
Yeah, but she was given at one point Claremore as her hometown because she was working with Will Rogers.
Oh, of course.
Who was from Claremore. Well, her line that caused all the trouble back in the mid-1930s, some reporter asked her about Claremore, and you remember the line?
Oh,
and she
yes.
said, Claremore stinks.
Had to do with the mineral waters.
The mineral water baths. That was the place where everybody went for the natural baths, and it did. It smelled pretty bad, and now,
smelled like boiled eggs and chili for breakfast.
That's right. A little bit of sulfur dioxide. And so when she was, I remember because of being from close to Claremore, when she made her little comeback in Straightjacket, somebody asked her about Claremore, and her line was, Claremore still stinks. But she doesn't have much to do in this, but it's nice to see her in it. And she holds up pretty well, too. But
Rochelle Hudson has been around a long time. In fact, before her starring roles, her starring breakouts at the bigger studios, before her supporting breakthrough at RKO and Secrets of the French Police, yes, followed immediately by The Savage Girl, sort of a female Tarzan in 32. Mm-hmm. Right around this same period of time, and even before the RKO breakthrough, Rochelle had played the voice of Bosco's girlfriend in the Warner Brothers cartoons.
Really?
Amazing.
Amazing indeed. That I did not know that.
She was a very gifted comedian.
She was.
And of
she
course
did well as an ingenue in that. I can't remember which Will Rogers film she was in. I don't think it's They Had to See Paris, but it may be.
I don't have a vivid impression of that, but we could sure look it up.
Right.
That's why we have reference books.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So she had a little bit of a comeback with those, but I'd like to talk, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I'd like to talk about my personal experience with a guy who had a meaty role in The Night Walker, and that's mm-hmm. Hayden Rourke.
Oh, of course.
Who later on went, became Dr. Bellows in I Dream of Jeannie, and that's how everybody remembers him. But he's plenty scary in The Night Walker.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, in 1971, and I'll try not to, get too far afield here, but mm-hmm. in 1971, I was getting ready to go on active duty with the Navy. And my friend Steve Olam, a college friend of mine, had worked for 2 summers in L.A. for Ben Lane, the makeup artist at Screen Gems.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, look, if you're going to the service, and I knew it was going to be in December, so says, this summer, let's go to L.A. We'll visit the sets, and I'll take you around and all of that. So I said, fine. So we go out to L.A., and Hayden Rourke had a kind of a rat pack, I guess, for lack of a better word, which included Virginia Gray. And I was thinking of the singer, and I just lost her name, and I should have written that down. Maybe I have it written down here. But she was on the Dean Martin show at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also Paul Lynde was a part of his group.
Oh.
And I'll think of the because she was very nice to us. We got us into the Dean Martin show and we watched a taping. But then Hayden asked us out to his house for cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out there, and I think we'd probably visited the set of Steve worked on Bewitched as well as I Dream of Jeannie, and we'd visited the sets and met Lisbeth Montgomery, and I got to see Alan Jenkins play a little small role in a Bewitched. And so we went out there, and he met us at the door, and you could not have been more old Hollywood.
Mm.
He was in a burgundy smoking jacket, and he came in, or invited us in, and he was living with the director, Juss Addis.
Mm-hmm.
And people probably know Juss Addis best, at least people of our ilk, know him best for directing Crybaby Killer, which
sure.
was, Nicholson's breakthrough.
Jack Nicholson's first starring.
Right. And he'd also directed Ann Corio on Broadway in White Cargo.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat there, and of course, this was one of those deals. This is 1971, and we're from Oklahoma, and they have cocktail napkins that say Hayden and Juss. And we just really didn't know what to make of all of that. And he took us into a room and showed us he had a full wall of every star in Hollywood that had signed photos for him.
Whoa.
And then we sat down, and we started talking about The Night Walker, and I told him how much I loved The Night Walker. And in that old Hollywood way, he says, I believe I have some stills from The Night Walker around here somewhere.
Ooh.
And he goes and gets them, and he's showing me these stills behind the scenes. One of the Westmores making him up for his role in The Night Walker as Barbara Stanwyck's husband, who
right.
of course is burned up in the fire but keeps coming back. And he says, and I said, oh, these are great. I was just really, there was the guy that I'd seen 5 years earlier that had scared me to death showing me these stills. And I guess I was just a complete fanboy. By the way, the fourth person I just thought of in that Rat Pack was Kay Ballard.
That's okay, sure.
I was trying to think of. Yeah. Very nice to us. So he's looking at these photos and says, John, I believe I have duplicates. May I give you a couple?
Whoa.
And I thought, oh, Lord, well, sure, yes. He says, May I sign them for you?
My goodness.
Oh, what a sweetheart. So he signs the first one. To John, I hope I have the pleasure of being in your first horror film. Sincerely, Hayden Rourke. And the second one is him being made up and is, what a way to make a buck. It was a great pleasure meeting you, Hayden. Two of the most valued pieces in my collection. And such a wonderful guy. And to see him in this, where he is really a scary figure.
What a striking appearance he has in that film. It was quite the amazing presence. And you really want to believe that this is an undead apparition.
You do.
Not to give anything away. And of course, Castle does have his gimmick, which is things are not what they seem.
Right.
Of course, I've always felt that the 2000 picture, What Lies Beneath, borrowed very heavily from The Nightwalker in its big turnabout ending.
Yeah, I've never thought about that either, but that's right. Yeah. And it's that whole deal, and we don't want to give away too much of it. But there is that whole deal also about, as you say, things are not what they seem, which is really, to me, the culmination is in a beautiful scene in the middle of this picture. And let me just do a quick synopsis. Barbara Stanwyck is a woman who lives with her blind husband in a home, and the home bursts into flame, and he's allegedly killed. But she keeps having dreams, not only where he comes back, but also a character who is only referred to in the credits as the Dream, Lloyd Bachner, played by Lloyd Bachner, who,
correct,
of course, anybody who ever watched television in the 60s saw Lloyd Bachner. He was everywhere. And there is one scene near the middle, and I won't talk it to death, but there's one scene near the middle of the picture where she doesn't know if it's a dream or reality, which I think, of course, presages the Wes Craven Nightmare on Elm Street pictures.
Right.
But, you know, where she's willing to accept it, whether it's reality or a dream or whatever it is. And that is a wedding scene that is one of the scariest, at the same time completely bloodless, one of the scariest scenes that I remember coming out of the 60s. And it still holds up very well. You know, all of the people are involved, and Hayden is there, and Lloyd Bachner, and it's just a wonderful scene. And it shows you that you know, William Castle maybe didn't need the gimmicks to fall back on.
No, Castle had been a very important B-movie film noir director in the 40s.
Right, you've given me some of his films. The
yes,
films,
yes,
right?
He worked on the Columbia Bees, and he worked for the Independents, and he worked on the Fringes. He was not a major. I don't think Hollywood ever acknowledged him as a major director, but he certainly was there for a crucial evolution in the film noir or dark film movement. Mm-hmm. And when he became associated, of course, he returned to Columbia during his really productive period at Strategic Points,
yes.
And you would see, gosh, I knew this guy was capable of bigger things. What's he doing with all these gimmicks? Well, the gimmicks were wonderful. Mm-hmm. The gimmicks, I mean, for a guy who had really come up in the industry and became a self-made director as opposed to an anointed director.
Yes.
He did a lot of pace setting. I think he loved the charade that he might be pretending to inherit Alfred Hitchcock's Master of Suspense mantle. I don't think Castle ever took himself that seriously, but he was a literate, articulate artist who could talk about his influences as openly as he could create things from whole cloth. Mm-hmm. He told me once that he had based House on Haunted Hill, for example, on a combination of Agatha Christie and Richard Connell. And then there were none in The Most Dangerous Game.
The Most Dangerous Game, sure.
And then he turned around to me and said, yeah, Sammy Glick's got nothing on Bill Castle. You know, referring to Sammy Glickstein What Makes Sammy Run, the great Hollywood plagiarist.
Yeah, Bud Schoenberg, Bud Schoenberg's
yeah.
novel, right.
But the dream sequences in The Night Walker, coupled with that wonderful, eerie theme of music by Vic Mizzi.
Yes.
Mizzi, of course, being most famous for composing the Addams Family theme.
Mm-hmm.
But the leitmotif, the melodic theme for The Night Walker, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, mm-hmm. this descending arpeggio that goes to its conclusion and then goes back up slightly below where it started, takes it down again, and then repeats it. It's got the haunting rhythm of a really good nightmare.
Yes.
And of course, that's got as much to do with it as the camera work, as the wonderful set dressing, that chapel full of what appears to be corpses but turn out to be wax dummies.
That's right.
A wonderful piece of work, and of course we mentioned What Lies Beneath, and I think it bears hammering a bit that Bob Zemeckis, who did What Lies Beneath, also became responsible during that same early turn of the century period for a studio called Dark Castle,
mm-hmm.
where did they get that name? Well, they're remaking Bill Castle. In some cases,
13 Ghosts and
13 Ghosts, The New House on Haunted Hill, etc.,
right, sure.
And embellishing on it, and then doing new stories or what you might say derivative new stories in a style such as Castle might have done himself.
Well, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
So the world is very small and getting smaller all the time, and it's nice to find somebody that's not afflicted with this tribal amnesia where they forget everything that came before.
That's right. That's exactly right. And how long has it been since you've seen Nightwalker?
Very recently, within the past couple of months.
And we did too, and I watched it with Joy and Emily, and it was just I was very pleased at the way that it holds up, you know, because you think, well, gimmicky, but it's not. It's very solid.
It can still give you a case of the shivering willies.
It can indeed, and that's what we're all about, is the shivering willies. So. Michael, let's get to the part of the show where we or the podcast where we talk about what's coming up. Now I know you've got Forgotten Horrors 3, the remake coming up.
The revamp. And it is a revamp. A lot of additional material, a lot of a complete new art kit with a few exceptions that were just too good to leave out.
Well, I was privileged to help you on that one. Matter of fact, that's the first one where I came aboard.
Yes, that was the beginning of the long term mm-hmm. experience, and I'm very pleased to have it wrapped. Our first full collaboration occurred on Forgotten Horrors Volume 4,
right.
which is coming up very soon. It's like this is well, it, in a way it's tedious, in a way it's like playing billiards.
Right.
You just got to get all the ducks in a row and make sure the chronology is correct, and then you've got to assure yourself and the reader that you're not just reprinting a piece of work that's been around for years. You're actually renewing it.
Right. Well, let me mention Comics from the Gone World.
Oh.
How many volumes are you up to on that?
I think we've done 10 all told.
And I would really recommend Comics from the Gone World, and I don't quite know how to recommend them, except to say that they're a little bit Theater of the Absurd.
Oh, yeah.
They're a little bit vulgarian burlesque.
A lot of really cornball, mostly Yiddish burlesque humor.
Right. And they also, for some, against all odds, managed to keep the same story arcs of the stories that they have rewritten. And to get into this, and folks, I've got to tell you, Michael Price is the guy who once reimagined Being in Nothingness as a hot rod comic from Charlton. And I've seen this, and this kind of just sort of gives you an idea of where Michael is coming from. Michael's angle of vision is always intriguing. And in these, Michael has taken the Iger Studios, but not the Iger Studios back when he had Eisner and Matt Baker and Al Feldstein and all those people, but it was Robert Webb and some of those guys. And he's taken the really 50s horror comics from the lower end, people like Ajax Farrell, that were being filled by the Iger Studios people, and taking them, stripped out the dialogue, except in some cases you keep the dialogue.
In some cases, the original dialogue is sufficiently absurd to stand up.
Right. Sometimes you just can't airbrush the lily, can you? I mean, there it is. Other times, there's comic touches, comic, I guess you go out on different, I'm looking for a word here, which I'm losing, and that's what happens when you get to be my age, but there are, you go out on different tangents, certainly comic tangents, and I find the books absolutely hilarious, and maybe even more than that. So I would recommend Comics from the Gone World, Amazon.com. You can do a sample of one for pretty inexpensive, or what? You got some $15 ones out there, don't you?
Oh yeah, we're doing the repricing gradually, mostly to coincide with special gift shopping seasons. But of course, we always I tend to put up samples at Facebook. The connection with Craig Yeo, editor of IDW's Haunted Horrors series. We're not exactly collaborating so much as we are kind of supporting each other's efforts. Sure. And of course, Craig is reprinting these censor bait comic books from the 1950s intact, good restorations, clean representations as they originally appeared. My tactic is to restore the art and then get out the trite and over obvious dialogue and then replace it with utter foolishness.
And you do a fine job.
You know, I mean, the endangered heroine in a Niger shop story says, "Oh heavens, what a horrible monster." In a Comics from the Gone World panel, the same endangered heroine will look at the rampaging creature and say, "Buzz off, sluggo."
That's right. That's right. And you have gotten your inspiration from the Iger Studio, and also the inspiration for the name of the whole series comes from the Beat Movement, right?
Oh yeah, Lawrence Ferlinghetti's Pictures of the Gone World, one of the seminal books of Beat poetry.
There you go. Highly recommended for adventurous readers who aren't afraid to laugh. And I also have to say, I have been looking over once again our collaboration on Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree, and I've got to say, I've done a lot of books. I've done a couple dozen books, and I have to say that that one is just absolutely one of my favorites. And if you think that you might think like us and might enjoy the kind of stuff that we enjoy as expressed on these podcasts, I think you'll enjoy Nth Degree, Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree. Anything else we can plug?
Oh gosh, I think we're covered very well. I do look forward to getting the new third volume of Forgotten Horrors out in print. And in the meantime, we're seeing good numbers on the Hounds of Zaroth. That is the new Most Dangerous Game book that George Turner and I started working on in 1968.
Oh my, really? And so is it out?
It is out and in print. I dug out all George Turner's and my original working files, which mainly were lists of titles, that is, films influenced by the human hunting humans motif of The Most Dangerous Game, and then had some fortunate connections come up with, Steve Bissett contributed some ideas. And he says, "Man, you can't let this book pass without covering The Hunger Games." I says, "Well, gosh, okay, great, excellent, perfect capper, brings it right up to the present day." But the picture covers a sweep of movies from 1932 through 2013.
Great. And we've got coming up on the horizon, Forgotten Horrors 7.
Oh, yeah. Falling together even as we yak.
Excellent. Well, it's always fun, Michael. Thank you so much. And I've been hearing from some people that have been listening to the podcast, and we want to thank everybody for listening to the podcast and for listening to our, well, if we ever do a book, Michael has suggested a book of these podcasts could be called Talk to Death.
Which is the only way to address such topics.
Michael, we'll check you next time.
Lovely.
Thank you.